I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Stephen Smith, Alfred Kohl's Professor of Political Science and Professor of Philosophy at Yale University. We're discussing his 2021 book, Reclaiming Patriotism in an Age of Extremes, from Yale University Press. Smith works on the history of political thought, especially modern political thought, and is the author of 6 books and many articles. Well, Stephen Smith, let me say, first of all, welcome back to the Political Theory Review.
It's a pleasure and an honor to be with you, Jeff. Thank you very much.
Stephen, this is it's a great book. I very much enjoyed reading it. It's a compelling argument, I think, to retrieve or reclaim, as you say, a form of patriotism from the extremes on the left and the right today. A very clearly written book, and brings your mastery of the history of political thought to bear in making your case. So well done, as always, with the book. Let me ask you just, first of all, what motivated you to write this book in the first place?
Thanks, Jeff. And thank you for that, for those introductory remarks and for your kind words about the book. I became interested in this question quite a while ago, and long before I imagined a book out of it. I began thinking about patriotism, and this will tell you kind of where the thing started, back in the period almost immediately after 9/11, when I had many students who were interested in the question of what could they do for their country? How could they best serve their country? And I had students, not many, but more than previously, who were entering military service and were doing things like that in risk for national security and the like. And I began to think about the question, this question, what do we owe our country? It seems like an obvious one for a political scientist, and yet I was struck by how little political science actually had to say about the question of patriotism or love of country or what do we owe our country and a variety of questions related to that. I began giving a lecture on the topic that I called In Defense of Patriotism, which was the concluding lecture to a class I was giving at the time, which was an introduction to political philosophy. And sort of there the topic remained for many years. I did not think about doing a book. It was not part of a book. I thought it would be a lecture, and that was about where it would stand. And yet somehow the idea began to take, to grip me, to began to think that this is a question that needed further explanation. And particularly because I saw in political science, especially, or political theory to be more specific, the rise of sort of in the post-Cold War period, the rise of, you know, cosmopolitanism, citizens of the world, experiments with kinds of post-national sovereignties, globalist orientations of different kinds, all of the things that worked against the idea of patriotism or what we owe our country. The idea came to be said that nationalism or national sovereignty, at least, was a bygone idea. It was an anachronism in this day and age. We live in a kind of alphabet soup of these, global organizations, the WTO, the NAFTA, et cetera, et cetera. And that questions, again, of loyalty to country were seen as a hallmark or a benchmark of something of a kind of benighted past. And there was something about this that just seemed to me deeply false and just false to our experience as citizens and as political animals. So this is what one of the things, or maybe a principal thing, that motivated the idea of the book. The book was not written, you know, all at one sitting. At various times I gave up on the book and I gave up on the project, but I was always kind of came back to it. I should also admit one other thing. One of the things that inspired me to write the book is I enjoyed just the little frisson of seeing the faces of my colleagues and others when I was asked what I was doing, telling them I was writing a book favorable to patriotism, and seeing the look of shock, disbelief, sometimes horror and disgust on their faces as I said this. I must admit that part of it was deeply appealing to me as well, as always something of a contrarian.
So you're reclaiming patriotism, which means you're drawing on the past in a large part of the book. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about patriotism's history, just to kind of get us started, in which you draw on kind of past historical thinkers in order to make a case for it. Maybe you just start with the concept of patriotism, what you take it to mean, because it's somewhat of an ambiguous concept, actually. And maybe you can, you know, sort of walk us through some of the high points that you take to be the in the history of thinking about patriotism.
Right. Thanks for that. I'm not offering what I think is necessarily a new definition of patriotism. Patriotism means today, I think, what it's pretty much always meant, which is love of country. The term, I talk about this in the book, it goes back to the Greek word patris, or place of one's ancestors, and probably more famously to the Latin patria, or homeland, fatherland, something like that. It's an ancient disposition, although there's, and it is something that the ancient writers in various ways discussed. I think of Livy in particular. Livy's history discusses how it is that the love of country had developed in Rome took generations, if not centuries, to create a kind of love. He relates it to love of the land and love of the soil. And of course, we always think of patriotism in the ancient world as this sort of heroic and self-abnegating spirit, maybe most famously associated with that story told by Plutarch, although which is best known through its retelling by Rousseau in Emile, of the Spartan mother, you know, who asks a slave how the battle is going. As he tells her that her five sons have been killed, and she says, "Base slave, did I ask you that?" And he says, "We won the battle," and she runs off to the temple to give thanks. I mean, that kind of famous image of the absolute self-abnegation of the citizen to the common good and to the success of and military strength of the polis or the city. That's the ancient model, and it runs throughout various, you know, there are various heroic stories in the ancient world of this kind of heroic and self-abnegating patriotism. The story of Brutus, you know, the sons of Brutus, he has to kill, he's the founder of the Roman Republic, but his sons are conspiring to bring back the Tarquin monarchs, and he's in charge of executing his own sons, which he regretfully has to do, you know, in front of the city. That shows, again, this kind of heroic and self-abnegating aspect of patriotism. But one of the things I try to show in the book is that modern patriotism grew out of a critique of this model of citizenship as simply far too demanding on human beings, and in a way sort of historically inappropriate to the modern world in which commerce and trade and other fast modern science and other things just made this kind of polis model of patriotism inappropriate. And in the book, I talk at some length, not great length, but a little bit, about early modern figures like Montesquieu, like Adam Smith, who in the Theory of Moral Sentiments has some fascinating remarks on patriotism in contrasting classical and modern patriotism. And of course, the Federalist Papers for creating a new kind of republicanism and therefore a new kind of patriotism, one which was real, but again, not as demanding as this ancient model, and which was more attuned to modern concepts of individuality, of the idea of a private sphere within, you know, a separate private sphere distinguished from our role from the public, or distinguishing the role of the private person from the citizen, and how modern patriotism came to be redefined to make it appropriate to a market economy, a representative form of government, and a kind of enlightened world shaped by science, commerce, and the like. So that was sort of, that's just to give you a rough historical kind of arc of where the concept came from and sort of how I trace its transformation.
Yeah, and I just to dig into the ancient modern distinction a little bit, because, you know, in some ways I'm as curious about the difference. Is it the case that, you know, the core difference between ancient and modern forms of patriotism is that, you know, the moderns kind of, well, expect less out of citizens than the ancients? Or is it that, you know, the essence of patriotism or the object of patriotism has changed, that, ancient forms of patriotism were more martial in nature and modern forms of patriotism are more, I don't know, civic, democratic, participatory? I mean, how do you think about that? Do you think it as a, you know, I don't know, quantitative or qualitative difference, no, put it that way?
That's a great observation, I think, on this. And you're right to say that modern patriotism has become in some way less martial. It's not that we don't require armies and that we don't need people to engage in military service and other kinds of dangerous work that protect our societies, to be sure. And it's in these high moments, especially of war, conflict, that, you know, patriotism is most visibly a part of our conversation. But I think also, and I think this is at least how I read or how I interpret what you just asked, patriotism is not only something that needs to be demonstrated in moments of national emergency or acute national crisis of some kind, but it is also an everyday disposition that citizens that hold us together as citizens. Things, I mean, these seemed innocent at one time, now perhaps a bit less so. Things like standing at the national anthem or saying the Pledge of Allegiance, or these sort of routine activities in a way, mocked in some ways because of their routine character, but these are forms of civic expressions of civic loyalty and civic identification. They obviously don't require heroic, sacrifice on the part of citizens, but they are forms of expressing civic loyalty. And it is this concept of loyalty that I argue in the first chapter is central to the idea of patriotism. So I think patriotism has become, maybe I think the term I use at one point in the book is a lowercase virtue. It doesn't always have to be up there in, you know, with a capital letter or with in italics. It's an everyday disposition that is needed as much in our, again, daily life as it is during moments of extreme crisis and emergency.
Yeah, good. I was also wondering when reading these chapters on the history of patriotism, is do you think, is patriotism necessarily connected to republicanism? That is, it's, you know, patriotism isn't just about loyalty, but it's loyalty to a particular kind of regime, namely a regime that, you know, we share in common. Or can, I mean, it seems weird to me to, that you could be patriotic to a monarchy, but maybe that's just because it's just my American republicanism speaking.
It may be just an, it may be your American republicanism to speak. The book is written with America in mind, and that patriotism in the American case is loyalty to a particular regime type, namely a republic. And I spent a fair bit of time talking about how it was that the Federalist authors, in many ways audaciously, came to redefine a republic. They used this Roman term, this ancient term, but gave it a very different meaning. You know, it would be large. Everybody before thought republics had to be small. It would be entirely representative, whereas earlier republics were in some way thought, or early experiments in self-government were thought of as direct forms of political rule. And it would be much more broadly egalitarian in the sense that it would not be a kind of mixed constitution in the way that we think the Roman Republic was, or that existed even in Great Britain. It's not that people in Britain, I mean, it would be ridiculous to say they can't be patriotic because they don't live in a republic, and Britain is not a republic, in, at least in our sense of the term. Of course they can, but my book is really written with the American case in mind, and the identification of patriotism with the cause of republicanism is really something that began in the revolutionary, or maybe immediately pre-revolutionary period, where, you know, the country divided up between, what were called patriots and loyalists. The loyalists wanted to hang with Great Britain and were happy to be part of the British Empire and share in the privileges and rights of British citizenship. The Republicans wanted a new kind of government and a new kind of society, wholly our own. And they appropriated, or the language of patriotism was appropriated for that purpose. So it became deeply identified with the cause of republicanism. Of course, after the revolution was fought and, you know, the settlement was arranged, then the future of the that we would have a republican form of government was in some ways kind of unproblematic. The question was, of course, what kind of republic would it be? So it became a debate within, you know, different kind of understandings of what a republic would be, but the association of patriotism with republicanism as a regime type seemed to be at that point, from that point on, settled and fixed. So for this reason, I'll just go back to the beginning of your question. The book seems to address, or it does address, the American case very, very specifically, and doesn't profess to offer advice to other peoples and other nations of how or what form their patriotism might take.
Yeah, and so to narrow in the American case, because we've been talking about the reclaiming patriotism part of your title, but the other part of your title is the In an Age of Extremes, which is also equally important to the book. You're talking about reclaiming patriotism in an age of extremes, the left and the right, who don't, in your view, get this dispositional loyalty or enlightened patriotism, as you call it, quite right. I thought we could sort of talk about both camps and how you respond to both. And you start with the nationalism side of things, because that's where you start. So maybe you can start just by talking about the nationalism of the right today, and how, you know, how you think that they, you know, have a corrupted, or, you know, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, wrong view of this virtue. You put it in terms of Aristotle, right? They have a, you know, like, it's a good, they're not hitting the golden mean of patriotism. They have this sort of excess of loyalty, which you call nationalism. Maybe you could talk about that and how where they go wrong.
Good, because that is, in a sense, where the book begins. You asked me when we kicked off about how I came to write the book, and I talked about when I first began thinking of this topic, all the energy seemed to be on the side of cosmopolitanism. You know, we were living in that transnational world. The EU was taken by many people as a kind of idea of how politics could be conducted in a kind of transnational sphere or space. Today, things have flipped considerably, and that's where I begin the book, because patriotism is not only confronted with the problems of, you might say, globalism, but in a very real sense, it is confronted with the reemergent forms of nationalism that have appeared in the U.S., to be sure, but throughout the world, in all kinds of places, Hungary, Russia, Israel, China, these are highly nationalist countries. And at least in the U.S., it is nationalism that has appropriated the language of patriotism for itself. On the day I remember of January, the day that will live in infamy, January 6th, I think one of the calls of the besiegers of the Capitol was "Patriots to the front," and this idea that this was patriotic is somehow deeply anathema to me and to the argument I'm making in my book. Nationalism and patriotism. Nationalism is right, as you say. I do put this in kind of an Aristotelian continuum of excess and deficiency. And if cosmopolitanism is the sort of deficiency of patriotism, nationalism is its twin, its excessive twin. Those many people will just associate patriotism and nationalism. I think they're very different. They grow out of, I would say, a common root, the desire to have a way of life and a way of life, your way of life, to be strong and respected. I think that is a natural and legitimate aspiration. But I also think nationalism and patriotism move in different directions. I give a kind of genealogy of nationalism in my book. I won't go over it here unless you want me to. But what I argue is that the language of nationalism has, at least in the 20th century, morphed into a language of grievance, resentment, anger, and sort of ethnic exclusivism. I make a point at one place in the book to say the language of white nationalism is often the way people on the nationalist side identify themselves. The language of white patriotism makes no sense. You never hear anybody say they're a white patriot, where white nationalist is often a term both of condemnation, but also of self-identification for those on the extreme right. So this tells me there's something very different about these two, and that patriotism is not an ideology of anger so much as gratitude, of loyalty to who we are, gratitude to our people, to our country, for what it has done, how it has shaped us. But at the same time, and this will be my last point on this, Jeff, at the same time, patriotism is capable of feelings of shame and regret. To have pride in your own country is just the reverse side of feelings of shame or for moral failings that our country has done. Patriotism does not just suggest, as its critics say, just kind of uncritical acceptance or adulation of everything of the national experience. In fact, patriotism is capable, so I argue, of a kind of critical self-reflection and internal critique that also makes it rather different from the nationalist point of view.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. I mean, all your points are well taken about, you know, the argument against contemporary self-styled nationalists. You know, to talk about Yoram Hazony, for example, who wrote a recent book about nationalism, which has a very, you know, it's very homogenizing in its understanding of what nationalism is. And I think that's all quite wrong. I mean, I guess, you know, part of though the reason why I think contemporary nationalists are wrong is it strikes me that, I mean, at least one way to respond to contemporary nationalists on the right is to point out that they, I don't know, are misusing or corrupting the history of nationalism itself. Like there was, you know, that not all nationalists in history are, you know, ethnic nationalists or, you know, sort of fundamentalists. But you mentioned in your book figures like Johann Gottfried Herder, who has, you know, a much more liberal conception of nationalism. So I guess in one way, like, you know, sometimes when I think about how to respond to these contemporary nationalists, why not sort of say that they, you know, have corrupted a better form of nationalism? We need to, correct their course on nationalism, rather than to say, no, just drop the nationalism bit and turn it over to patriotism, you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. No, that's good. You know, let me just say a word about Yoram Hazony's book, because his book, The Virtue of Nationalism, I'm rather harsh with it in my book. But that's in part because I think it is, in fact, the best book on the subject of the recent kind of, you know, new nationalists. There's been a spate of books about nationalism and articles written about it. I actually think Yoram's is the best. So I wanted, that was the one I wanted to go after. I mean, it would have been very easy to just, you know, pick some rather low-hanging fruit. But I actually think his argument, although I profoundly disagree with it, is in many ways quite powerful. But let me go back to your question about, well, why not just say what we're seeing is a corruption of nationalism, and rather than trying to, I'm not really trying to get rid of nationalism, which is to say, I mean, I can't, you know, it's part of our landscape, and it's been part of our world for, you know, the last, hard to give a date, when did nationalism begin? You know, we think of it as a phenomenon of beginning in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. And Herder, as you pointed out, I discuss him at some length in the book, is often thought of as one of the first and early exponents of a kind of liberal, what we think of today maybe as kind of a liberal nationalism. His was a nationalism particularly focused on language. Herder was fascinated by different languages. He read, interested in the way language is not just used as a kind of instrument for achieving our goals, but language was a form of self-expression. It told us who we are as a people. The language shapes the people, a people, and gives them an identity. And this was a kind of what has come to be called liberal nationalism. The great 20th century political philosopher Isaiah Berlin was in large part responsible for sort of rehabilitating Herder and rehabilitating the kind of liberal nationalism with which Herder was associated. And Berlin too was a kind of liberal nationalist. So the idea is not in any ways necessarily self-contradictory. And the 19th century, of course, was sort of the high point of the world of what we might think of as sort of liberal nationalism. All of the great statesmen of the 19th century were both liberals and nationalists. So Lincoln, Mazzini, Gladstone. I mean, you can go on down the list. You know, and even into the 20th century, there's an honor roll of people who were liberal nationalists. The problem was really it came in the 20th century, and especially became evident after World War I with the breakup of the great empires, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Russian Empire, and where the nationalities question, as it came to be called during that period, came to dominate, where it was argued you know, the famous Wilsonian arguments about national self-determination, that each people needs a state. And that process of combining the nation with the state is something that went back considerably further. But in the immediate post-World War I period, it came to take on a kind of life of its own. And this created tremendous difficulties, as we all know, for people, the peoples who had found safety and security and a measure of freedom under these great empires, but who fell outside what you might call the ethnic majority of their nations, and suddenly found themselves homeless, suddenly found themselves victimized by this, and sent into exile. And this created a massive upheaval and massive displacement of people. And we might say that nationalism in this period became militarized, or what do we say today? It became militarized, and the language of nationalism came to be used as a kind of weapon, not just of an appreciation of natural or linguistic or cultural differences between people, but it became a weapon for distinguishing who's the ins and the outs, as we might say, the friends and the enemies, if you want to use that language, which has become very, very popular, very, very forceful today. Who's the friend? Who's the enemy? Who's the other? Who is other? And the people who don't fit into the dominant national ethnic type were deemed in many ways others. They were othered. They became seen as enemies of the people. And in that way, nationalism became weaponized. And was there an inevitability that Herder's humane and liberal form of nationalism would inevitably morph into this militarized form, or kind of Schmittian form of us and them? Well, I mean, nothing in history, as we know, is inevitable. Things didn't have to happen that way, but they did. And that has become, in different ways, part of the nationalist imaginary, the nationalist imagination. It's not going to disappear any more than the other side of the cosmopolitan or so on will disappear. These are modern, in many ways, in certain ways, specifically, peculiarly modern dispositions that I think are troublesome from both sides, and why I think it's important to, from which it's important to distinguish patriotism as a more humane and enlightened alternative to both of those sentiments.
Sort of draw on a perennial or universal concept to moderate the tendencies of these distinctively modern concepts is an interesting strategy. I want to ask, just in particular on this, in listening to you, and we had a seminar about your book last week here at University of Houston, and we brought up some of these similar issues. So I appreciate sort of, you know, going around on these issues again, which is great. But, you know, one of the ways it seems to me to distinguish patriotism and nationalism, and just to sort of get your take on this, is patriotism seems to me to be more attuned to the political things, whereas nationalism seems more attuned to the pre-political things, right? So you use the example about Herder and language, which is very true. Herder is very insistent on thinking about German language and, you know, various languages of various people around the world. But it would be weird to say that you can, you know, part of your patriotism involves being patriotic about your language. That doesn't seem to, or, although maybe that's wrong. What do you think about that? I mean, as a rough and ready way to think about the distinction, because if that's right, if it's a distinction of political versus pre-political things, you can kind of understand why there's more of a tension there with liberalism, because if nationalism is going to prescribe certain pre-political norms, you're already in tension with the kind of private sphere that liberalism wants to enshrine.
No, thanks. That's very good. We talked a little bit earlier about how American patriotism is connected to this idea of a republic as a particular kind of regime. Children, when they say the Pledge of Allegiance, I guess they still do in school. I'm not sure, but who knows?
Yeah, my kid does.
They do.
And the Texas Pledge, too. Yeah,
Texas Pledge. Okay. Well, they what do they pledge to? To the republic. I pledge allegiance to the flag and the republic for which it stands. So, you know, already in our pledge is this idea of the republic. I mean, no child knows what a republic means, but there is that word. And the patriotic pledge is pledged to, in a way, something that captures both elements of what you were saying, to the republic, which is to say a particular regime form and a particular type of political order, but also to the flag, a symbol, and something that is not as clearly a, you know, political, it's not a political institution, but it is a symbol of that polity. And what I want to argue, or what I've tried to argue in the book, is that patriotism, as I understand it at least, entails both of those things, or encompasses both of those things. It is ours is a patriotism of what I call a patriotism of principle, a kind of principle based on the principles for which we stand, the ideals of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, our formal regime, as it were, but that patriotism is also a form of what I call ethos patriotism, and which encompasses what you were talking about, nationalism. Ethos covers more broadly what you might call our way of life in kind of broader, not necessarily political sense, our habits, our manners, our language, our cuisines, our music, the things that shape to some degree who we are as a people, and have made us what we are. The last chapter of the book talks a little bit about how it is these aspects of ethos, patriotism, our culture, our arts, our sciences. These are part of the American way of life. And I argue that American patriotism is a matter, want to use two kind of fancy words for it, both logos and ethos, both, that is to say, of principle as well as habit and sentiment.
Yeah, wanted to switch over from talking about the nationalist right to talk about the cosmopolitan left.
Okay.
Because this is also another, you know, one of the extremes that you want to you know, reclaim patriotism against. It seemed to me in the book that you were talking about two different camps of the left, as it were, which is, I guess, just a sort of rough and ready way of talking about them, that kind of, on the one hand, Kantian or Stoic universalism, cosmopolitanism that someone like Martha Nussbaum would represent, that regards, you know, those folks regard patriotism as sort of unjustified narrowing of our moral horizons. But that you're also concerned about the kind of newer left, which is a kind of identity politics, identitarian left, that regards patriotism as itself a form of identity politics. And so I thought we could just sort of talk about both, but, you know, talk first about the cosmopolitan, the Kantian Stoic, Nussbaumian form of cosmopolitanism, and what, you know, so what's the, I think you said already that it's you know, it's an excess of a form of patriotism, but, you know, how do you regard their arguments, their sort of challenge to patriotism? What's your response to that?
Right. No, the left critique of patriotism does have this kind of dual side, and the most, in some ways, the challenge of the kind of cosmopolitan left that I spend a fair bit of time talking about, you said, is kind of characterized most vividly by Martha Nussbaum, although in her recent book, even she's had to walk back some of her early enthusiasms. That represents one side of the critique of patriotism from the left. The other, as you rightly point out, comes from what I call in the book the New Age Left, sort of to distinguish it from the New Left of the 1960s. This is the New Age Left, identity politics, sort of, which in many ways, in peculiar way, is kind of the Janus face of the nationalist, because they're both seeking identity as the form. The nationalist assumes its identity with something called the nation. The New Age Left associates identity with your ethnic group, with your, you know, your racialized ethnic group of some kind. There's a kind of similarity in their views, oddly enough. But that's also a very, very powerful dissolvent of patriotism, because it's very difficult to have. I mean, patriotism requires us to have, at a minimum, some kind of consensus around who we are, where we've come from, and where we're going. And that may be a great deal to ask in this day and age, where in the world of, you know, cancel cultures of different kinds, in the world of the New York Times' 1619 project, you know, the very meaning of what it is to be an American can now no longer be taken for granted. And part of what the book is about is an attempt to sort of attempt in a certain kind of way to restore a kind of basic faith in what it means to be an American and certain things around which, the last chapter deals with this, around which Americans can take a sort of justified pride in what has made us what we are. This is obviously not a proposal that's going to get the, you know, support of everybody. Obviously, we live in a deeply, as the title of the book suggests, we live in an age of extremes. And yet what the book is trying to do is to recapture patriotism. It's a kind of capture the flag in a certain sense from both those who I think have misused it on the right and those who are contemptuous of it on the left. And I think there is a broad swatch of the American public that is basically, you know, within the arc of what you might call the center left to the center right, for whom, you know, patriotism in this somewhat older sense of the term might still be of meaning or of value.
Yeah, I was wondering about this. I mean, in terms of, you know, you have this story in the book, which is great, about you know, talking to friends of yours about your working on patriotism and how, you know, the kind of shocked faces that you get. But, you know, I mean, part of me, I was wondering about this is in the sense of, you know, since we live in such polarized times, it strikes me that a lot of people on the left are hungering for a form of nationalism. It's just the sort of expressions of it are a little uncomfortable, right? Like the Pledge of Allegiance, or, you know, singing the national anthem at football games, or, you know, that these have come to be associated with the other side, as it were. Mm-hmm. But that there's some hunger for a different kind, because I take, you know, a lot of the kinds of critique from some of the identitarian, some of the identitarian left, I'm sure, I don't know much about this, but they're, I'm sure, sort of anti-American in some ways, but, you know, against the American project. But I'm sure a vast majority of them are also pro-American. It's just they want to express their patriotism through, you know, critique of existing social structures, right? So I guess I, you know, maybe you could speak to, you know, the plight of the left in a certain way. I mean, how you conceive of how they're relating to the American project, whether you see it as a kind of fully anti-America project, or whether you think that there's room, you know, for recapturing, you know, a form of patriotism.
You know, what you just said rings true, and very much true. The question is how can we express this sentiment, especially at a time when it seems to have been, you know, it seems to have become monopolized by people on one side of the spectrum. And even what were, you know, not too long ago regarded as simply harmless or ordinary expressions of patriotism, the national anthem, have now become deeply politicized and, you know, what it represents. One of the things, the book is not really about prescriptions exactly, but one of the prescriptions it does have at the end of the book is a proposal that I think would help a great deal in reclaiming patriotism. I don't know how realistic it is, but nevertheless, I put it out there, which is a plan for national service. Americans don't know each other. We live in this vast country, separated obviously by geography, by culture, by education, by economics. We all know increasingly people live in silos of, you know, their own identity, and they don't hear other people. They get their news from one source and they don't listen to another. A proposal for national service would be a proposal not just for people who want to go into the military, although that would certainly be part of it, but for people who, young people who wish to, you know, teach school or to serve in a kind of underserved community, work in a national park or something like that. But something that puts maybe for 2 years, whether it's after high school or after college, it might depend on people's life circumstances, but something that would put people in a world that's not just the one they've grown up with and put them in touch with people of a kind that they haven't known before, and to realize, to kind of humanize. I mean, one of the things that I so much dislike about the nationalist language is that there's a kind of dehumanization that goes with it. And is it important to humanize people again, and to recognize that we are all part of a, we may disagree, but I said at one point in the book, for all of my disagreements with multiculturalists, they're not enemies of the American people. I mean, this language of culture war, you know, we were at war in World War II. We were in war in Vietnam or in Korea. We're not at war with other Americans over how they think of our national identity. I mean, we may disagree with them and disagree strongly, but better to recognize this. Let us listen to each other more. And one way of doing this, I think, is in my suggestion for some kind of national service. I can go on, but...
Well, no, I mean, just to interject, I mean, because I love this suggestion in part because it seems to me one of the great ills from the left and the right is the way in which, I don't know, politics has become so performative and virtue signaling, right? Yuval Levin's most recent book and the sort of the performativity of modern politics is sort of, there's so much, you know, performative activity without much actual activity, right? And it creates such unnecessary forms of conflict. One of the things that your sort of national service suggests is you actually have to do something, right? And through the activity, you build certain kinds of habits. You build that ethos that you're talking about. You can kind of extend your principles to others. And you actually have to, you know, I mean, patriotism, even if it is a more attenuated in the modern age, does have to actually involve some kind of sacrifice, right? To express your commitment to the polity that you have to set aside maybe ages 18, 19 years old, and you don't do partying, but instead you go help teach inner city schools, something like that. I mean, that so it's actually sort of an expression of a commitment that you don't have to do if you just, that doesn't exist for, you know, you're just like saying something on Twitter about how you stand for this or that group, which requires no effort and no sacrifice.
No, I think that's very true. And I mean, I think one place I've noticed this at Yale. I'm sure it's true of most colleges. Young people want to do something. They'd love to find ways of helping. They want to serve, giving back to the community or something, you know, that's often the term that people use today, giving back. But they may not know how, and it may not be obvious what the route to that is. I mean, for example, here at Yale, I mean, the offices are very good with helping students connect up with iBanking firms and other kinds of, you know, big corporations. It's less good at helping students find a path to public service in some ways. Part maybe because the avenues don't clearly exist. Programs like Teach for America, which were, I'm not quite sure how it's doing now, but at one time was very popular, was one way of doing this. But I do think it could be something on a wider, on a national basis. And, you know, students want to do that. Young people want to do this. They want to find a way to give back. And there is often not the resources for them to do this.
Yeah, so I thought we could turn, you know, to talk finally about your version of enlightened patriotism. I was curious, I guess, first of all, just sort of how you came up with that term, enlightened patriotism. You know, are you intending to draw a connection with the European Enlightenment, or is it just sort of a kind of distinction with, you know, sort of brute or unthinking patriotism that you mean to draw?
I thought I needed a qualifier before mm-hmm. patriotism. I thought I needed a qualifier. I had various other ideas. I won't mention them. They're probably not very good. Maybe enlightened patriotism is not very good, but it did capture for me. It wasn't so much thinking of the what we think of as the Enlightenment, you know, the 18th century movement of that name. But I was thinking it in a more, well, perhaps a less specific sense to suggest a patriotism of ideas. A patriotism of aspiration, and which is also something that the nationalists dislike. They dislike the idea that America is an idea that seems to them false, where it seems to me very much true. We speak of something called, I mean, it's not officially canonized in any text or doctrine, but we think of something called the American Creed or the American Dream even. What is it to be, you know, what is it that Americans believe? You know, there used to be a kind of creedal dimension to patriotism built around notions of equality, liberty, separation of powers, and the like, balanced government and the like. There used to be certain kind of ideas associated with what it meant to be an American. And I wanted to find a term that maybe hadn't really been used up or identified in the past that would designate this concept of sort of the aspirational aspects of patriotism. Samuel Huntington, the great political scientist, spoke in his book about America as what he called a creedal nation. And as a people of the book, we are often, he believed, given to bouts of what he called creedal passion. where what we are doesn't measure up to what we think we should be or what we ought to be. And at certain moments, that passion boils over into the form of protest and popular forms of discontent. But that's what it means to be a creedal people, is to live with a certain kind of perpetual discontent. May be too strong, but I'll use that term, a kind of discontent with what we are, and a realization that we are not necessarily what we should be. And I think it's very important to maintain this kind of aspirational aspect of American patriotism that I try to capture under this term enlightened patriotism, and that I think gives America its distinctive cast. One of the things that the nationalists want to do is they just, you know, I think they reject is the exceptional character of them. I'm very much an American exceptionalist. I believe strongly in that concept and talk about it in the beginning of the book. And I think part of the exceptional character of America is connected to this idea of aspiration to what we ought to be. It was, you know, it was there in the Puritan idea of the city on the hill. It was very much part of Lincoln's conception of what America, you know, in the goal of equality to which he argued we needed to be committed. And it really represents and of course it was, the idea, the Winthrop City on the Hill, was, of course, most famously sort of revived by Ronald Reagan, where he used that image to tie us into this broader narrative of idealism and aspiration. I think that's central, and it captures something of what I wanted to get at in using that term, enlightened patriotism.
Yeah, that's great. I had this question in a minute about exceptionalism, so I'll ask it now just to sort of follow up on that strand. You know, it seems to me this is one of the things that just arouses so much passion in American politics, is to talk in terms of American exceptionalism, in part because I think people are confused or have an ambiguous, you know, it's sort of an ambiguous term, and people are maybe talk past one another. I mean, as you point out in the book, I mean, the term American exceptionalism, or the way it was originally developed, was a kind of descriptive term to refer to the exceptional, that America is an exception, and that it didn't develop through sort of European feudal trajectory. So it didn't follow the usual rules of political development. But it has come to take on more of a normative cast, in the sense that, like, America's great, America's exceptional, and there's exception in the world. I guess, you know, and of course then there are the you know, people who object to that, right, to say that America's great because, look, you know, we're ranked 51st in the world or something on some health or education score. Yeah. I mean, maybe you say a little bit about how you think about American exceptionalism in terms of the, you know, whether, you know, it's sort of the more descriptive or more normative approach, and if it's the more normative approach, you know, how do you it's a matter of, I guess, splitting the difference between the critics and the boosters of American exceptionalism.
Good, I'm glad you raised that, because exceptionalism, in a way, the book sort of begins and ends with discussions of exceptionalism. You're right to say that it's a term that in many ways is problematic. I'll just use two examples that I reference in the book. When Barack Obama, and I'm forgetting what year it was, kind of early, I think, in his first term, said that he thought America was exceptional, but in the same way that every country thinks they're exceptional. So, you know, he got a tremendous amount of blowback because of this. It wasn't exceptional enough just to say, you know, that every country is sort of exceptional in its own way. Exceptional has come to mean sort of indispensable. But I would also say, and I found this out actually thanks to a brilliant student of mine, Molly Shapiro, who got footnoted in the book, in a some kind of rally before he was a presidential candidate, Donald in Houston, I believe it was, Jeff, there was a where Donald Trump equally said he was against the idea of exceptionalism for much the same reason. It sounded to him like he thought we were, it made us sound better than everybody else. And of course, we know that both Trump and Obama sort of later on walked those statements back. But it's just a way of saying that, you know, people have, from both the right and the left, have in some ways been troubled by this idea of exceptionalism. Another example I use in the book was to show what a kind of litmus test the term has become, that you remember a couple of years ago or so when the television comedian Roseanne Barr tweeted those comments about Valerie Jarrett's really kind of racist comments. And she was asked later on some TV show why she had done this. And she said it was because Jarrett and Obama don't believe in American exceptionalism, as if this has become the litmus test for whether you're an American or not, is to believe in exceptionalism. That kind of weaponizing of exceptionalism, just like the weaponizing of nationalism, has become, you know, a feature of the right. Whereas in fact, the term, you know, we often sort of trace it back to this Puritan idea. We are a people, a city on the hill, in which the eyes of all the world are watching. What an extraordinary thing when John Winthrop made that remark, I think in 1620, although all the world is watching here, a tiny handful of, I guess, English, mainly English settlers in a world virtually uninhabited by Europeans, at least, could claim that the eyes of the world are watching us. I mean, what confidence, you know, what to believe such a thing. And yet there was sort of truth to it at the same time. And for Winthrop, at least, this idea that we were creating a city on the hill, a biblical image, we are creating a kind of new Jerusalem here in the wilderness, a new people, a new people with, you know, recreating a kind of community of saints in a certain sense. This was strongly connected with an idea of humility and backsliding. The world is watching us, so we have to be careful. It was not just a call for a kind of triumphalism, which is the way the term, I think, as you described it, has come to be thought of, but it was a call for humility. And in fact, the two should be connected. That our awareness of ourselves, of course, the idea, we don't think of ourselves creating, I mean, a new holy city any longer. But we do see America in many ways as bearing the torch of liberty in that way, as to the world, and as a model of human rights and of human liberty for the world. We do that. But always that claim needs to be combined with a sense of our shortcomings and humility, not as a cudgel to be, you know, to be beating other people or beating fellow citizens with for being insufficiently, you know, attuned to our exceptional status. I probably wandered off a bit from where your question started, Jeff, but it does bring us into these, you know, into these areas, and I think that it's very important for patriotism to retain this idea of what makes America a very exceptional country.
I find that really appealing way of thinking about exceptionalism, because it's not a form of triumphalism, in to use your terms, but it's rather a form of humility, or what might gloss what you're saying in terms of a responsibility to the world, right? I mean, I actually, this is not to return to a thinker, well, we didn't talk about, but Fichte, one of the figures that you talk about in terms of the nationalism movement,
the way I read addresses the German nation, you know, is very much in these kinds of terms that, you know, Germany for him is a sort of beacon of moral development. And, you know, his view, they have a responsibility to the rest of the rest of Europe. Right. And, you know, so it sounds similar in that way. And that's, I mean, I find that appealing in terms of the sort of outward facing version of patriotism that, right, it's not a form of jingoism or like I'm better than you kind of view, but I have a responsibility to the rest of the world, right? I'm not better than everybody, but I have a responsibility to help improve the conditions, right? Is that how you think of that?
I think so. Let me just your statement that it doesn't mean we're better than you, or I mean, one of the points I want to make about patriotism, I mentioned earlier that patriotism I associate with a form of loyalty and other loyalty related virtues. We live in a web of loyalties to family, to institutions that we work in, you know, or my, you know, to sports teams that we like, and to countries that we live in. We live in a web of loyalties, and those loyalties demand responsibilities of different kinds. I think the family, the comparison of family to patriotism, which I use in the book, is useful to a point. And I mean, a country is not the same thing as your family, especially a vast country. Family is an association of intimate, direct relations. But when we love our families, we don't say we love our families because I live in the best family. I mean, that would be an utterly preposterous statement. What would it mean? My family's better than your family. I mean, we don't talk that way. It makes no sense. We often love our families despite, our manifest flaws and failures. That's part of what makes each of our families different is our, you know. And the same is true of loyalty to country, you know, in my view. You know, patriotism doesn't require us to say, you know, my country's better than yours. You know, any more than it requires me to say that my family is better than yours. Patriotism and loyalty demands of us a kind of gratitude, which is an important part of my book in its discussion of patriotism, kind of gratitude for shaping us and making us who we are for many ways, for better and worse. We have our national character types that we all enjoy, but also we also kind of enjoy making fun of too. You know, you go to a foreign country and you can immediately spot the American, you know, for our, you know, mannerisms, our not just our language, our mannerisms are, you know, very distinctive. And sometimes they can be a source of cringeworthy, you know, effect, but also we also take a pride in who we are and what we are. That's part of patriotism. It doesn't mean that our manners and habits are superior. So I think that patriotism is a form of, I think I've sort of lost touch with your initial question. Oh, about responsibilities to others. Yeah. That is something I talk about in the book. This is a point actually I got from Adam Smith's discussion of patriotism in his fascinating treatment of it in his book, Theory of Moral Sentiments. You know, he says there used to be, he makes a distinction, he also makes a very useful distinction between ancient and modern patriotism. The ancient kind was harsh, he calls it inhumane, you know, Cato ended his speeches, you know, Carthage, Delendo, you know, Carthage must be destroyed. There was a harsh and militaristic. He says modern patriotism is humane, and I'm forgetting, he may even use the term enlightened, possibly. And that means a kind of concern for the welfare of others. You know, we don't live in little islands. You know, the welfare of one family is connected, you know, to the well-being of the neighbors around them. You know, if your neighborhood is falling into ruin and disrepair, I mean, that's not a good thing for you. And the same is true for countries as well. You can't live in you can't be successful really in an island of dysfunction. And we know what happens when countries, I mean, there are countries where I think of Israel, where there's a lot of dysfunction around the country, and you know, it's not good. So enlightened patriotism does require a kind of outward. It's not just an inward looking cult of me, what the English, you know, the attitude that in England they used to call "I'm all right, Jack," you know, just, you know, you go for yours and, you know, screw everybody else. It does require us to take a kind of broader look at, you know, the world we inhabit.
Right, or America First, right? Not, you know, that's what I'm thinking in contrast to America First view, which is in many ways turned away from the city on a hill, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So let's. I wanted to conclude by just the last, in your last chapter, you list a series of substantive themes of American patriotism that would involve, which I found this to be really helpful, because usually in discussions about what it means to be an American or American patriotism, you know, it often has a kind of abstract flavor that, you know, we're a creedal nation, as you say, or, you know, there's some commitment to, you know, patriotism of principle, but you actually go through a series of themes, just a list, you know, a few of them: equality, rule of law, limited government, pluralism or diversity, culture and the arts, invention and discovery, economic opportunity, individualism, faith and hope, exceptionalism. And I found all this very persuasive as a sort of way of characterizing it. I thought what you could do is maybe say a little bit about, I found very evocative the metaphor you use there in talking about these themes. They're themes as in a symphony, which I found interesting. You could talk about a little bit about that and how you think about the relationship among these different themes, because obviously, you know, there's the way in which they conflict, right? Equality and limited government have historically conflicted in the American imagination. Individualism, economic opportunity conflict. So how does a patriot, an enlightened patriot on your view, sort of reconcile the various conflicts among the themes that constitute America?
Well, great, Jeff. Thanks for pointing out the last chapter. And I actually have to say I had a lot of fun writing that chapter, because I really thought the book needed to, it's not exactly a how-to list by any means, but it is an attempt to try to speak a little more specifically about sort of the core ideas of patriotism suggest, at least to me. And you're right to point out that these don't all exactly hang together in any kind of, you know, logical manner. They're not entailed, you know, as philosophers like to talk about. One thing isn't entailed by the other by any means. And in many ways are just like our national life is not, is combined of a range of ideas that don't necessarily or easily fit with one another. Just to take obvious examples like liberty and equality, we embrace both, but you know there can be tension. There can be and are genuine tensions between them, between things like equality and economic development, where economic development and I'm a believer in the market, and I talk about that, where economic development, as we're seeing, can also pose challenges for equality. I talk a bit about pluralism and diversity, which I'm a great believer in the importance of pluralism. I talk about what I call a reasonable pluralism, which is, you know, pluralism of the kind that Madison endorsed in Federalist 10. But I'm also deeply critical of what has become the kind of cult of diversity, where that means a kind of imposed or forced sense of pluralism, imposing it as the ultimate value on all others. It's become a kind of dogmatism, an absolutism built around this concept of diversity, where it kind of trumps every other. And that also seems to me to stand in sharp contrast with notions of liberty and the like. So these are all, in many ways, a bundle or a kind of package of ideas that shape American, what I think of as American national identity. And part of our national identity is we have to learn to live with those tensions. We're a large, complex modern society. We have to learn to live with these tensions, and in a way to learn to balance and to moderate them. I mean, one of the points I make also is when I talk about I'm a defender of, you know, the economic development and the market. But I also say that the founders were not libertarians. They didn't believe that government had no role in shaping economic policy or in attempting to mitigate, not eradicate, but to mitigate excesses of inequality and injustice. But it's a plea for trying to hold a number of these things together and to try to embrace even the tensions that exist within them or between them.
Well, that's great. And, you know, great place to end. So Stephen, it's been great talking to you. I appreciate you coming, even though now you're, you know, of course, a celebrity, having David Brooks laud you in the New York Times. You graced me with your presence. So I appreciate your time. Thanks for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Jeff, you're too kind. I'm not a celebrity, and you know, I'm glad.
Just wait.
I'm honored, like I said at the beginning, I'm serious honored to be asked back to come to speak with you, to be interviewed by you. Really appreciate your care with which you obviously thought about the book and the issues raised by it. So thanks so much.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.